Hello everyone, before we begin this episode, I just wanted to provide one final reminder that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold has partnered with Season of Justice, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping families shed new light on their unsolved cold cases. We thank everyone for their support thus far, but as one final refresher, Season of Justice provides grants to investigative agencies that fund DNA testing and forensic genetic genealogy research to solve cold cases. And it also helps fund such resources as billboards which spread awareness about these unsolved cold cases and urge people to come forward if they have information. As an example, they raised the funding for a billboard about the unsolved 1996 murder of Leon Laurelis, which I covered on episode number 297. Since 2020, Season of Justice has raised over $1 million in grants for more than 140 cold cases in North America, and at the time of this recording, 6 of these cases have been solved. But they still need the support of listeners like you, which is why we're asking you one more time if you would consider donating to Season of Justice and help them bring victims' families ever so closer to a resolution. You have one last day to donate to Season of Justice, so please visit the website givebutter.com/SOJ_thetrail or text trail24 to 53555. You'll also find links and information about this in our show notes and on our social media pages, and we have a donate button on our website at trailwentcold.com. Like I just mentioned, our campaign with Season of Justice lasted the entire month of February, and you still have one last day to donate. Thank you very much for your support, and enjoy the conclusion of our special two-part anniversary episode. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be presenting the second half of our two-part series about the 1959 murder of Lynn Harper and the controversial conviction of Stephen Truscott. We released part one last week, and it goes without saying that if you haven't heard that episode yet, I highly recommend you go back and listen to it, since it contains most of the key information about this case. But as a refresher, the murder of 12-year-old Lynn Harper is one of the most infamous cases in the history of our podcast, Home Country of Canada, as the individual who was charged and convicted of the crime was a 14-year-old friend and classmate of Lynn's named Stephen Truscott. Lynn and Stephen both lived with their families at a Royal Canadian Air Force base in Clinton, Ontario, and on the evening of June 9, 1959, Stephen claimed that he picked up Lynn at their school and gave her a ride on his bicycle to Highway 8, just over 1 kilometer away. Shortly after he dropped her off, Stephen said that he saw Lynn climb into a passing car driven by an unknown individual, but she never returned home that night, and her body was found in a woodlot called Lawson's Bush 2 days later. She had likely been sexually assaulted and was strangled to death with her own blouse, but the police did not believe Stephen's story and suspected that he took Lynn into the bush in order to rape and murder her. Even though the evidence against Stephen was very circumstantial, he was charged with first-degree murder, convicted at trial, and sentenced to death by hanging. Obviously, the idea of executing a 14-year-old boy was met with a public backlash, so the government of Canada commuted his sentence to life imprisonment, and after serving 10 years behind bars, Stephen was paroled in 1969. He then went on to start a new life under a new name and got married and had children, but by the late 1990s, Stephen decided that he wanted to put his story back into the spotlight and prove his innocence. Indeed, it would turn out that a lot of potentially exculpatory evidence was withheld from Stephen's defense team at his original trial in 1959, and there were also issues with some of the evidence which the Crown had used against him. When our last episode ended, Stephen's case had been referred to the Court of Appeal for Ontario, and in June of 2006, it was brought before a 5-judge panel who would hear testimony from 17 witnesses and review 250 new pieces of evidence over 1 3-week period. This would lead to some shocking new revelations, which I'm going to discuss momentarily, and once I'm done sharing the remaining facts about the case, I'll provide my theories and analysis about what happened. So without any further ado, let us now continue to explore the murder of Lynn Harper. So I'll start off by discussing the presentation of Stephen Truscott's case in front of the Court of Appeal for Ontario in 2006, which will require me to provide a refresher on some of the evidence from Stephen's original trial. As a recap, Stephen always maintained that on the evening of June the 9th, 1959, he and Lynn left Air Vice Marshal Hugh Campbell School together on his bicycle, and while there's always been dispute about the exact time they left, Stephen said it was around 7:25 p.m. They headed north on County Road and passed a woodlot known as Lawson's Bush, which is where Lynn's body was found 2 days later. Stephen claimed that they soon crossed a bridge which ran over the Bayfield River, and he then dropped Lynn off at an intersection of County Road and Highway 8, where she hitched a ride in a car and was never seen alive again. Of course, the authorities always alleged that Stephen never made it to Highway 8, and instead took Lynn into Lawson's Bush in order to kill her. However, several witnesses established that Stephen did arrive back to the schoolyard on his bicycle at around 8 p.m. and then returned home to babysit his two younger siblings. So if Stephen was guilty, the crime had to have taken place during a window of around 35 to 60 minutes. The most crucial piece of evidence presented at Stephen's trial was testimony from a pathologist named Dr. John Peniston, who performed the original autopsy on Lynn and examined her stomach contents. Before she left her house, Lynn finished eating dinner with her family at 5:45 p.m., but the meal was not completely digested when she was killed. Dr. Peniston testified that since it would have taken Lynn no more than 2 hours to digest this food, her death likely occurred sometime between 7:15 and 7:45 p.m. And therefore, since Stephen was with Lynn during that window of time, he must have been the killer. Well, as the years went on, there would be a lot of questions about the accuracy of Dr. Peniston's assessment, and even Peniston himself may not have had much confidence in it. The Court of Appeal for Ontario would be presented with earlier draft versions of Peniston's autopsy report, which had been withheld from Stephen's defense team at his trial in 1959. It turned out that Peniston had initially written down 3 different estimates for the time of Lynn's death, and 2 of these estimates were for times later than 8 p.m., when it was established that Stephen was at home babysitting and had an alibi. There was also no time or date listed on the final version of Peniston's autopsy report, so no one could pinpoint when exactly he wrote it. But the first piece of official documentation where Peniston listed the time of death as being between 7:15 and 7:45 p.m. was dated July the 6th, nearly 1 month after Stephen was charged with murder. This gave Stephen and his supporters the impression that Peniston had only settled on the specific time frame in order to fit the police's narrative, rather than using solid scientific evidence to reach his conclusion. Another piece of evidence which the defense did not know about at the original trial was a handwritten police bulletin, which had been penned and sent out by the lead investigator, Inspector Harold Graham, on the evening of June the 11th, 1959, only a few hours after Lynn's body was found. The bulletin stated that Lynn had likely been killed at 9 p.m. on June the 9th, but this 9 o'clock estimate was never mentioned again after Stephen was arrested because, of course, his whereabouts after 8 p.m. on the night of the murder were accounted for. This same bulletin also urged police to be on the lookout for suspects with scratches on their face, neck, hands, and arms, but no one ever reported seeing any fresh scratches on Stephen after the crime took place. I mentioned in our last episode that the Supreme Court of Canada agreed to review Stephen's case in 1966 in order to determine if he was entitled to a new trial, but after a 5-day hearing took place, they ultimately voted by an 8-1 majority to uphold his conviction. However, it turned out that before this hearing took place, Dr. Peniston had sent a letter to Inspector Graham in which he wrote about having made a quote-unquote agonizing reappraisal of his original testimony from Stephen's trial and seemed to be second-guessing his findings about Lynn's time of death. He wrote that even though his conclusions may have been accurate, they were, quote-unquote, not incompatible with death at a later time, and acknowledged that Lynn may have been killed as many as 12 hours after her last meal, which would have placed her death during the early morning hours of June the 10th. However, this letter was never turned over to Stephen's defense attorneys, and Peniston was not called upon to testify at the Supreme Court hearings. The letter was not entered into evidence until the Court of Appeal hearings in 2006, and since Peniston was deceased by this point, he could no longer provide any clarification on his statements. The defense would call some expert witnesses to the stand who attempted to debunk Peniston's original conclusions. One of them was Nicholas Diamond, a gastroenterologist at Toronto Western Hospital, who testified that a person's stomach almost never completely empties within 2 hours of having a meal, as it can still contain up to 70% of its contents after that much time has passed. Peniston believed that Lynn had not digested anything since he found nothing inside her small intestine during his autopsy, but Diamond claimed this logic was faulty, since food often empties from the stomach in minute quantities and can travel very quickly through the bowels. The Crown tried to counter this by bringing in Dr. Werner Spitz, one of the most prominent forensic pathologists in the world, who testified that Peniston's estimates about Lynn's time of death seemed justified and accurate. But Dr. Spitz admitted that he had not seen Peniston's letter to Graham or the draft autopsy reports he wrote with the differing times of death, so Spitz conceded that Peniston, quote-unquote, may have made a mistake. Well, one expert witness who tore apart Peniston's analysis was noted British forensic pathologist Dr. Bernard Knight, who testified that there was no way to determine a victim's exact time of death based on their stomach contents and how quickly they digested them. In addition to discrediting Peniston's original testimony, the defense's new strategy would involve utilizing entomology to prove that Lynn died at a much later time than between 7:15 and 7:45 p.m. Insects and maggots were collected from Lynn's body when she was found and have been preserved as evidence, so the defense would call upon some entomology experts who believed they could make an approximate estimation about Lynn's time of death based on when the insects deposited their eggs or larvae. One of these experts was Elgin Brown, a biologist who had been working at the Ontario Attorney General's Crime Lab in 1959. At the time, Brown prepared a report in which he wrote that the maggots found on Lynn's body were in their earliest stage of development, so he estimated that the insects had laid their eggs on the morning of June the 10th, and likely hatched later that afternoon at around 2:30 p.m. Brown believed that if Lynn had been killed before sunset on June the 9th, the maggots would have been much larger by the time her body was discovered. However, Brown's report was never presented to the defense at Stephen's trial, and he was not interviewed about it until 2005. Forensic entomologist Dr. Shara Van Leerhoven testified at the hearing and estimated that the insects on Lynn's body had started laying their eggs and larvae sometime between 11 a.m. on June the 10th and 8 a.m. on June the 11th, and Dr. Richard Merritt, the head of the entomology department at Michigan State University, also testified and pretty much reached the same conclusion. This would have supported the idea that Lynn was murdered after sunset the previous night, during the time period when Stephen had an alibi. Now, Dr. Neil Haskell, a forensic entomology professor from Purdue University in Indiana, testified on behalf of the Crown and shared a differing view. He believed that the larva was likely deposited on Lynn's body between 9 and 9:30 p.m. on June the 9th, which would have been within 2 hours of her death and pointed towards Stephen being her killer. However, there was some question about Haskell's objectivity, as prior to the hearings, he had left a voicemail with the Ontario Provincial Police in which he stated that he could do damage to the case for Stephen's innocence if they put him on the stand. The defense also tried to debunk the idea that the lesions found on Stephen's penis at the time of his arrest were caused by him sexually assaulting Lynn. As you might recall, when Stephen was taken into custody by the police, he was examined at the Huron County Jail by Dr. John Addison, his family physician, and Dr. David Hall Brooks, RCAF Station Clinton's senior medical officer, who both testified to seeing a pair of lesions on Stephen's penis, which were the size of a quarter. Of course, Stephen always maintained that these claims were greatly exaggerated, and the defense managed to unearth a report from a third doctor, Dr. A.H. Taylor, who was asked to examine Stephen at the jail after he was charged with murder, and wrote that he had not observed any sign of injury on Stephen's penis. But of course, Dr. Taylor's report was withheld from the original defense team, and he was never called upon to testify at trial. As a side note, the reason Dr. Taylor was asked to perform this additional exam is because Dr. Brooks said he couldn't tell if Stephen was circumcised and wanted Taylor to take a look and help him figure it out. Yeah, I think it goes without saying that one should question the credibility of a doctor who is unable to determine if someone is circumcised or not. At the original Supreme Court hearings in 1966, the defense had called upon a pair of dermatologists, Dr. Norman Wrong and Dr. Charles Danby, the latter of whom had treated Stephen while he was incarcerated at the Collins Bay Penitentiary. They both testified that these lesions were likely caused by a pre-existing skin condition rather than an injury related to sexual assault. A re-examination of the original police notes and reports would uncover new information which cast doubt on the credibility of the Crown's key witnesses against Stephen, and once again, this documentation was never made available to the defense at the original trial. As a refresher, one of these witnesses was 13-year-old Jocelyn Gaudette, who attended the same school as Lynn and Stephen, and claimed that on the night before the murder, Stephen had made a secret date with her to meet at Lawson's Bush, as he supposedly wanted to show her a cow and a calf at Bob Lawson's farm, which was located on the same property. Jocelyn testified that she was unable to find Stephen at their prearranged meeting time on the evening of June the 9th, which prompted the Crown to push forward a theory that Stephen had decided to take Lynn into Lawson's Bush instead. While Stephen always denied that he ever made this so-called secret date with Jocelyn, and according to these unearthed police notes, Jocelyn was interviewed multiple times during the early stages of the investigation, but never mentioned anything about this date until after Stephen was charged with murder. In fact, during her original interview with Inspector Graham, Jocelyn had told him that she went to Lawson's Bush on the evening of June the 9th to search for Lynn, but in later versions of the story, she said she was looking for Stephen. According to Jocelyn, after Stephen failed to show up at Lawson's Bush, she headed to Bob Lawson's farm at around 6:30 p.m. to see if Stephen might be there. Jocelyn testified that she waited there for Stephen for about 90 minutes or so, but when he failed to show up, she left. However, while Lawson did confirm that Jocelyn showed up at his farm that night, he said that she actually arrived at around 7:25 p.m. instead of 6:30, and was only there for about 10 minutes rather than a full hour and a half. Decades later, Lawson was interviewed when this story was featured on an episode of the Canadian TV show The Fifth Estate and shared a surprising new revelation. Lawson claimed that when Stephen's trial was taking place, Jocelyn went to visit him at his farm and asked him to revise his original story and say that he had seen her there at 6:30 on the night of the murder instead of 7:25, but Lawson refused to do this. Of course, the defense had no knowledge of this troubling inconsistency in Jocelyn's story during the trial. Jocelyn's account was also contradicted by the Crown's other key witness, Arnold Butch George, whom we'll discuss in more detail a little later. Butch himself gave a lot of inconsistent stories, but in one of his statements to police, he claimed that on the night of the murder, he had been searching for Stephen and bumped into Jocelyn at the tractor trail which led from County Road into Lawson's Bush. Butch said that he had asked Jocelyn if she had seen Stephen, and she replied no, and she then asked him if he had seen Lynn, and he said the same thing. So this seemed to indicate that Jocelyn had been looking for Lynn that night rather than Stephen, and since Butch said this encounter took place sometime after 7 p.m, this contradicted Jocelyn's story that she was at Lawson's farm from 6:30 until 8 o'clock. If that wasn't enough, 10-year-old Philip Burns, another key witness for the Crown, had also stated that he spoke to Jocelyn while walking down County Road sometime between 7 o'clock and 7:30 as well. At the hearing, new testimony was provided by a pair of women named Sandra Stolzman and Elizabeth Hulbert, who had been co-workers of Jocelyn when she was employed as a resident nurse in Montreal in the years following the murder. They both claimed that in 1966, Jocelyn became panicky over the idea that she might be subpoenaed to testify at the Supreme Court hearing and admitted that she had lied under oath at Stephen's trial and did so out of jealousy because Stephen had wanted to spend more time with Lynn than with her. Jocelyn also claimed that she was pressured by the OPP into changing her original story as they had taken her to the police station to be questioned after midnight when she was very tired. While Stolzman said that she told the police about Jocelyn's admissions back in 1966, nothing was ever done with this information. Now, you might recall that two of the strongest defense witnesses at the original trial were 11-year-old Doug Yotes and 12-year-old Gord Logan, who both testified that they were at Bayfield River on the night of the murder and saw Stephen and Lynn riding their bicycle over the bridge together in the direction of Highway 8. Gord also claimed that he saw Stephen riding the bike over the bridge again in the opposite direction a few minutes later, which would seem to support Stephen's story about dropping Lynn off at the highway. Well, the authorities attempted to cast doubt on Gord's credibility as he was fishing in the river about 600 feet away from the bridge, and they did not believe he could have seen and identified Stephen from that distance. But what the defense did not know is that police had performed their own test, in which they had an officer stand at the same spot where Gord would have been and observe a girl crossing the bridge. The officer wound up providing a very accurate description of the girl and her clothing, which suggested that Gord could have correctly identified Stephen, but the official report about this test was never disclosed to the defense. When the trial originally took place, the Crown attempted to discredit Stephen's story by pushing forward a narrative that Lynn never would have run away from home, or hitchhiked, or climbed into a car with a stranger. However, the original police notes seemed to go against this, because when Lynn did not return home, and her father, Leslie Harper, reported her missing at the RCAF guardhouse, he expressed concern that Lynn may have decided to hitchhike to her grandmother's house in Port Stanley, which was nearly 130 kilometers away. Before she left her own residence that night, Lynn had gotten into an argument with her parents because she wanted to go swimming, but her parents would not accompany her to the base's outdoor pool, which required adult supervision. When Lynn went to the school to help out with a scavenger hunt that the Brownies were having, she apparently told one of the Brownie leaders that she did not want to go home that night and was thinking about heading to her grandmother's place. The police never disclosed that a number of Lynn's friends had told them that she often liked to hitchhike, and one friend even claimed that they had hitchhiked together. On our last episode, I mentioned that some bicycle tracks had been discovered on the tractor trail leading from County Road into Lawson's Bush, and while the Crown tried to argue that they were from Stephen's bicycle, the tracks were likely made when the ground was wet. And since there hadn't been any rainfall in the weeks prior to Lynn's murder, the tracks were probably left there well beforehand and had no connection to the crime. However, another key piece of information which was withheld from the defense is that some fresh vehicular tire skid marks have been discovered on County Road, as well as some spinning tire marks at the crest of the tractor trail. The defense was also unaware that on June the 11th, an elderly couple named Mr. and Mrs. Fletcher Townsend had told police that on the evening Lynn went missing, they had seen a young girl hitchhiking on Highway 8 around the approximate time when Stephen said he dropped Lynn off there, though the Townsends acknowledged that they may have been mistaken about the date and could have seen this girl on June the 7th rather than June the 9th. But a more intriguing sighting was provided by Bob Lawson, who claimed that at around 10 p.m. that night, about 2.5 hours after Lynn was last seen alive, he and a neighbor decided to drive to the bridge in order to go swimming in the Bayfield River. While on their way there, Lawson said that he saw a red or maroon convertible, which may have been an early 1950s model Ford, parked alongside his property's fence on County Road. This spot was near the tractor trail into Lawson's Bush, and Lawson recalled seeing a man in the driver's seat and what may have been a younger girl in the passenger seat beside him, though Lawson did not get a clear enough look to be certain. Lawson said that he shone his headlights on the car, which prompted the man inside to yell something at him. A few minutes later, while Lawson was swimming in the river, he saw the same car speed past him down the road, and someone yelled out what sounded like obscenities at him. After he learned about Lynn's murder, Lawson reported his sighting to the authorities. According to the original files, police did speak to an airman who lived in the area and owned a dark convertible, and he acknowledged that he sometimes parked on County Road with his dates, though it was usually closer to the river rather than next to the tractor trail. The airman said he sold his convertible about 2 weeks after Lynn's murder took place, but it doesn't look like this lead ever went anywhere, and it was never established if this was the same car Lawson saw. Whatever the case, this sighting was never shared with the defense at Stephen's trial. So after the 5-judge panel from the Court of Appeal for Ontario heard 3 weeks' worth of new evidence and eyewitness testimony in June of 2006, Stephen's defense team would appear in front of them again in late January and early February of 2007. This time, the defense would spend the next 10 days outlining their arguments before the judges finally adjourned to make their decision. Well, over 8 months later, on August the 28th, the Court of Appeal finally announced that they had voted unanimously to acquit Stephen of all charges, writing, quote, "In a decision released today, the court unanimously holds that the conviction of Mr. Truscott was a miscarriage of justice and must be quashed. The court further holds that the appropriate remedy in this case is to enter an acquittal. The court thus orders that Mr. Truscott should stand acquitted of the murder of Lynn Harper," end quote. The judges felt that if the jury had full knowledge of the entirety of the evidence, there would have been reasonable doubt about the Crown's claim that Lynn was murdered before 8 p.m., and this may have led to Stephen being found not guilty. However, they also wrote, quote, "The appellant has not demonstrated his factual innocence. At this time, and on the totality of the record, we are in no position to make a declaration of innocence. In these circumstances, we cannot say that an acquittal is the only reasonable verdict," end quote. Given that nearly 50 years had passed since the crime took place, the court felt it would be impossible to grant Stephen a fair retrial, and Michael Bryant, the Attorney General of Ontario, announced that the Crown had no plans to appeal the court's decision. Bryant issued a public apology to Stephen on behalf of the provincial government and said that they were sorry for the miscarriage of justice. While Stephen could not be declared factually innocent, he felt that the court's decision had finally given him vindication and cleared his name. At Christmas that year, Stephen received a wrapped pizza box under the tree as a gift from his youngest son, Devin. When he was paroled from prison back in 1969, Stephen started living under the assumed name Stephen Bowers, which he was still using when he got married and had his 3 children. But when Stephen opened his son's Christmas gift, it contained documents which showed that Devin had now legally changed his last name from Bowers to Truscott. In July of 2008, the provincial government announced that Stephen would be paid $6.5 million in compensation for his wrongful conviction. He would later use this money to launch the Truscott Initiative in Justice Studies at the University of Guelph and fund scholarships for students in the field. In spite of the court's decision, Lynn Harper's surviving family still did not believe that Stephen was innocent. By this point, her mother Shirley had passed away in 1981, and her father Leslie was living at a nursing home in California. During interviews, Lynn's older brother Barry said that it was a quote-unquote real travesty that his sister's killer had been awarded millions of dollars, and Leslie said that the decision made him feel numb. Leslie would pass away in March of 2012 at the age of 94, and never wavered from his belief that Stephen murdered his daughter. In 2020, a Canadian film about this story titled Marlene would be released, starring actors Greg Brick and Kristen Booth as Stephen and Marlene Truscott. The main reason it was titled Marlene was because she was the film's central character, as it focused on her tireless pursuit to clear her husband's name. Since Marlene was known for having a meticulous eye for detail and a gift for retaining information, she spent a great deal of time researching the police files and court transcripts in hopes of uncovering new evidence to support her husband's innocence. In fact, this occupied so much of Marlene's time that she was forced to leave the workforce, and when Stephen was awarded $6.5 million in compensation, Marlene also received $100,000 for lost income. And incidentally, at one point during the film, Marlene says the words, quote, "The trail's gone cold," and I'd like to think it was an intentional homage to yours truly. Anyway, at the time of this recording, Stephen Truscott is currently 79 years old and continues to reside in Guelph, Ontario. But after nearly 65 years, there are still no conclusive answers about who was actually responsible for the murder of Lynn Harper. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. We'll be right back. So I often have conversations about the Canadian criminal justice system with people who live outside our country, and they sometimes hold the view that Canada can be too lenient towards violent offenders. And while that's technically not untrue, it always takes them by surprise when I mention that our country once tried to execute a 14-year-old boy via hanging. And this was only in 1959, less than a century ago, when you wouldn't expect a first-world country to still be hanging people. It's not hard to imagine why this case was so controversial, because many people felt that even if Stephen Truscott was guilty of murdering Lynn Harper, a minor should not be executed like this. Hell, even the jury that found Stephen guilty made a recommendation for mercy, but since hanging was still the mandatory punishment for first-degree murder in Canada at that time, Justice Robert Ferguson still sentenced him to death. Looking back, the thing about this case which particularly shocks me is not just the fact that a 14-year-old was nearly executed, but how quickly all these events played out. To recap, Lynn's murder took place on June the 9th, 1959, Stephen was arrested a few days later and convicted on September the 30th, and his original execution date was December the 8th. If a crime like this took place today, it would probably be years before it even went to trial, but Stephen was scheduled to be hanged just under 5 months after he was arrested. Now, before the United States ruled capital punishment for juveniles to be unconstitutional in 2005, there were numerous documented cases of offenders being executed for crimes they committed while they were 16 or 17. However, there would usually be years of appeals and delays, and the offender was an adult in their 20s or 30s by the time the execution went through. But if Stephen had been hanged on his original execution date, he still would have been only 14 years old at the time, and the visual of a teenage boy going to the gallows was too much for some people to handle. To put this into perspective, one of the youngest Americans to ever be executed was George Stinney, a 15-year-old African-American boy who was convicted of murdering two younger girls in South Carolina in 1944. That is considered to be one of the most controversial murder cases and executions in the history of the United States, yet George Stinney was still older than Stephen Truscott. So you can understand why this case helped play a role and the eventual abolishment of capital punishment in Canada in 1976. After Stephen was found guilty, he was held in the Huron County Jail to await execution, and has often shared a story about hearing the sound of hammering outside his cell window. While it only turned out to be routine construction, he was terrified that this was the sound of a gallows being built for his upcoming hanging, so I think Stephen was triggered by the sound of hammering for years to come. The general consensus seems to be that history now looks upon this story as one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in Canadian history, but there are still some people, including Lynn Harper's surviving family, who believe that Stephen Truscott was guilty all along. And to be fair, even though the Court of Appeal for Ontario vacated Stephen's original conviction, they did not declare him to be factually innocent. Yes, I suppose it was not proven with 100% certainty that Stephen could not have committed this crime, as unlike many other wrongful conviction cases, there was no available DNA evidence to exonerate him. While the timeline of opportunity for Stephen to have killed Lynn was very tight, it was not mathematically impossible. Barring the miraculous discovery of new evidence which points to an alternate suspect, I'm sure it will be difficult to conclusively prove Stephen's innocence after all this time. At the beginning of Part 1, I mentioned that sometime last year, I felt inspired to cover this case on our anniversary show after reading Until You Are Dead, Stephen Truscott's Long Ride into History, which was written by investigative journalist Julian Scher and is one of the most detailed and extensive true crime books I've ever seen. During the intro of his book, Julian Scher fully admitted that he was a bit skeptical when he was contacted by Stephen Truscott, because of course, virtually every convicted murderer is going to try and claim they're innocent. When Scher had his first face-to-face meeting with Stephen, he told him, quote, "If you want to prove yourself innocent, hire a defense lawyer. Our job is not to prove people innocent, but to find out the truth and go down any alleys, no matter where they lead," end quote. Stephen then responded, quote, "That's fine. I'm not afraid. Talk to anyone you find, investigate wherever things lead you. I know I'm innocent, and I'm not afraid of what you'll turn up," end quote. After reading Until You Are Dead, It's clear that after looking at all the evidence, Cher reached the conclusion that Stephen had been railroaded and was the victim of a terrible injustice. The book was originally published before Stephen's case was heard in front of the Court of Appeal for Ontario, but after they quashed his conviction, Cher released an updated version of the book which was retitled, Until You Are Dead, The Wrongful Conviction of Stephen Truscott. A number of books have been written about this case, with the first being The Trial of Stephen Truscott, which was published by Isabelle Labordet in 1966, and started the big push to overturn Stephen's conviction. Another book I've read was Stephen Truscott, Decades of Injustice, written by author Nate Henley, who actually appeared alongside yours truly at the True Crime Podcast Live in Toronto show, which was organized by Christy Lee of Canadian True Crime and held at Toronto's Royal Cinema in August of 2019. All these books hold the view that Stephen was innocent, but I'll try to be objective and look at this case from all angles. Now, from what I've seen of Stephen Truscott during his interviews, it's hard to imagine him being a murderer, as he really does come across as a kind, genuine man, and it sounds like most of the people who have met him feel the same way. This is a case where we now have the benefit of hindsight, because not only did Stephen have no known history of violence or getting into serious trouble before he was charged with murder, but he's been a model citizen and loving family man ever since he was paroled from prison over 54 years ago. I mean, it is hard to imagine someone committing such a vicious crime at the age of 14 and then showing no signs of violent behavior at all for the rest of their life. If Stephen was guilty, he easily could have continued living in anonymity under his new name, Stephen Bowers, for the rest of his life, but he made the conscious choice to come out into the open again and attempt to clear his name. He also showed no hesitation about requesting DNA testing, which could have conceivably proved his guilt, and while it turned out there was no longer any DNA evidence available, he could not have known that beforehand. There was also the risk of Stephen facing a potentially major backlash in his community once it was revealed that he was one of Canada's most infamous convicted murderers, but it sounds like most of the people who knew Stephen were nothing but supportive of him and did not believe he was capable of doing what he was accused of. As a side note, I grew up in Orangeville, Ontario, which is located less than an hour from the town of Guelph, where Stephen was living. I've been to Guelph several times, and from what I've heard, even before Stephen went public, it was pretty much an open secret in the community that people knew who he really was, but they never made a big deal about it, because they always felt he was wrongly convicted and wanted to respect his privacy. One of the things which really struck me when I read Until You Are Dead were the amount of character witnesses who were willing to go on the record and defend Stephen. It would be one thing if it was just his friends and family, but a number of people who knew Stephen from his time at the Ontario Training School for Boys and the Collins Bay Penitentiary had nothing but glowing things to say about him. As you might recall, after Stephen was convicted, he was remanded to the Ontario Training School until he turned 18, but even though the authorities warned the staff that this dangerous psychopath would be arriving, the staff were pleasantly surprised when Stephen turned out to be this quiet, polite, and respectful kid who caused no trouble. And when Stephen was transferred to Collins Bay a few years later, the staff and inmates there pretty much said the same thing. Now, these are people who are used to dealing with dangerous criminals who are good at lying and being manipulative, so I'm sure they are not easily fooled, but most of them reached the conclusion that Stephen did not belong in prison. Hell, they had such trust in the guy that during his last years there, they let him live in the minimum security farm annex and leave the prison to attend university classes during the day, even though he could have attempted to escape at any time. And when Stephen was paroled, one of the parole supervisors, Malcolm Steinberg, had no qualms about bringing this convicted murderer home to live with him and his family. While it's not overly surprising that a juvenile serving a life sentence for murder would be paroled after 10 years, parole boards generally require offenders to admit what they did and take responsibility for their crime before they let them out. But even after a number of psychologists forced Stephen to take truth serum and LSD in an attempt to extract a confession out of him, he never stopped maintaining his innocence. However, I think the main reason some people might still have doubts about Stephen is that he was the last known person to see Lynn Harper alive, and his story about his final interaction with her is admittedly a bit unusual. Stephen claimed that Lynn asked him for a ride on his bicycle because she wanted to see some ponies at a farm owned by a guy named Edgar Hodges. He then dropped her off at the intersection of County Road and Highway 8, and last saw her sticking her thumb out to hitchhike and climbing into a vehicle. But since Hodges' farm was located about a half kilometer away on Highway 8, it does make you wonder why Lynn wouldn't have asked Stephen to take her all the way there rather than drop her off at the intersection. And since Lynn probably could have walked that distance to the farm, why did she bother hitching a ride in a car? According to Hodges, Lynn never arrived at his farm, and it does seem odd that even though this car was supposedly traveling east, Lynn's body would wind up in Lawson's Bush, which is about a kilometer south from that intersection. This is why the authorities were inclined to believe that Lynn never made it to the highway, and Stephen instead took her into the bush in order to rape and murder her. But there are a couple of potential explanations for why Lynn might have asked to be dropped off at the highway. When she asked Stephen for a ride, he told her that he would be happy to do so because he was going up there anyway to see some friends who were at the Bayfield River. So perhaps Lynn felt she didn't want to inconvenience Stephen by asking him to take her much further than the river. And even if Lynn did tell Stephen that she was heading to Hodges' farm, how can we be certain that she was telling him the truth? Remember, she had gotten into an argument with her parents earlier that evening, and while it could hardly be described as serious, she did apparently hint to someone that she might be inclined to run away to her grandmother's house in Port Stanley. Of course, we have no idea if Lynn was actually planning to do that, but if she was, she may not have wanted to share this with Stephen, and her express purpose for going to Highway 8 was to hitch a ride to a much farther destination than Hodges' farm. However, if Lynn was murdered by an unknown party, we technically can't even be 100% certain that the driver of the car that picked her up was responsible. For all we know, they could have dropped Lynn off somewhere, and she was subsequently murdered by a completely different person. Even though Lynn was found in Lawson's Bush with a bloodied undershirt and her blood-stained blouse around her neck, there was very little actual blood at the scene, so it's possible that she could have been killed elsewhere before her body was dumped at that spot. And if Lynn was not actually murdered in Lawson's Bush, then you could safely eliminate Stephen as the perpetrator. Anyway, I think that most people would agree that regardless of whether Stephen was guilty or innocent, he did not receive a fair trial. I mentioned in our last episode that back in 1959, Canadian prosecuting attorneys had no obligation to turn over all evidence to the defense at a criminal trial. It would turn out that a lot of potentially exculpatory evidence was withheld by Crown Prosecutor Glenn Hayes, and while his actions were certainly unethical, they were technically not illegal at that time. It's reasonable to assume that if Stephen's defense attorneys had been able to present all the available evidence at the original trial, he might have been acquitted. However, one important point that Julian Scheer brought up in Until You Are Dead was that 1959 was just a much different time when it came to the public's trust in law enforcement and authority figures, and they had a lot more faith in the justice system. Unlike today, there was just not a general awareness of how wrongful convictions can happen, and you didn't have a ton of books and podcasts and documentaries out there pushing forward the narrative of an innocent person being sent to prison and the justice system gone horribly wrong. Even though Stephen may have come across as an unlikely candidate to be a murderer, a lot of people still held the mindset that if the police say he's the right guy, then he must be the right guy. I mean, when Stephen's father, Dan Truscott, was taken to the RCAF guardhouse on the night his son was interrogated, he was none too thrilled that the police had detained his son without notifying him, but as a military man, Dan was conditioned to have trust and respect for authority, and probably never thought that his son would be charged with murder if he didn't actually do it. And I think this mindset also applies to Lynn Harper's family. I mentioned earlier that even after Stephen's conviction was quashed and he received millions in compensation, the Harpers never wavered from their belief that he was guilty. I feel nothing but immense sympathy for the family because I can't imagine how traumatizing it must be to lose a loved one and be convinced that justice was served and the right person went to prison, only for all these old wounds to be reopened when the case returned to the spotlight decades later. While I hesitate to say anything negative about the Harpers, it must be stated that there were two separate occasions in which they seemed to change their original stories when they testified at Stephen's trial. Of course, I don't think they did it maliciously in order to railroad an innocent kid, as I'm sure they still genuinely believed that Stephen killed Lynn. But I think there's a good chance the police probably advised them what to say in order to increase the chances of a conviction. When Shirley Harper testified at trial and asked if Lynn had a history of running away or hitchhiking, she replied, quote, "Not to my knowledge." However, it really does appear that Lynn had hitchhiked on multiple occasions prior to her murder, which might seem unusual for a 12-year-old girl, but like I just said, 1959 was a much different time, and people had less awareness of the dangers of hitchhiking. It seems like when Lynn was first reported missing, her parents initially felt that she might have attempted to run away to her grandmother's residence, but this scenario was not pushed forward at trial because the Crown wanted to maintain the narrative that Lynn never would have climbed into a car with a stranger, so therefore, Stephen's story must not be true. The other piece of questionable testimony involving the Harpers was the discovery of Lynn's locket. On my last episode, I mentioned that on the night she went missing, Lynn had supposedly been wearing a locket which was an RCAF logo and a heart made of plexiglass hanging on a gold chain. She was not wearing it when her body was found in Lawson's Bush, but 8 days later, on June the 19th, a girl came across a locket matching that description, hanging on a barbed wire fence about 280 feet away from the tractor trail which led into the bush. At first, Leslie Harper positively identified it as Lynn's locket, but when he testified at the trial, he seemed to downplay this, stating, quote, "Lynn had one similar to it." Well, I think it's too much of a coincidence that such a distinct locket would be found only a few hundred feet away from Lynn's body, so I think it's safe to say that it belonged to her. But the problem is that the locket could have potentially blown a significant hole in the case against Stephen, since it was not found until the week after he had been charged with murder and was already incarcerated in jail. Now, it's entirely possible that the police simply missed the lock during the original crime scene investigation, since it was technically outside the bush. However, the day before the locket was found, Corporal Hank Sayo had collected soil samples from a spot right next to the fence and did not notice it. So could it be possible that Lynn's real killer kept her locket in their possession after they murdered her and decided to return to the scene on June the 18th or the 19th in order to place the locket on the fence? Granted, I'm not sure why they would do that, but I can see why the Crown may have encouraged Leslie Harper to downplay the significance of the locket, since it could have proved that someone else besides Stephen committed the crime. So now I'm going to attempt to break down the timeline on the night of the murder, and I can't think of too many other cases in which establishing a concrete timeline was so crucial. If this crime happened today, it would be much easier to use technology like cell phones to establish who was at which location at what time, but the world of 1959 must seem prehistoric by comparison. I mean, wristwatches still existed back then, but since these events took place outdoors, and so few of the key witnesses were wearing wristwatches that night, many of them were forced to make rough estimates about what time they did or saw certain things. There have always been differing accounts from different people about the exact time that Stephen and Lynn left the schoolyard together, and obviously, the Crown put more emphasis on the earlier times which were provided in order to open up a larger window of time for Stephen to have committed the crime. Stephen claimed they left together at 7:25 p.m., and that he got the time by looking at a clock through the window of the kindergarten classroom. At one point, investigators believed they had caught Stephen in a lie when they spoke to an electrician who told them that he had disconnected the school's master clock sometime before the murder, which meant that all of the clocks in the building would have been off about 5 or 6 hours from the correct time. This seemed to indicate that Stephen had fabricated a story about leaving at 7:25, but it turned out that the school's kindergarten teacher had requested that a separate electric clock be installed in her classroom. So yes, Stephen still could have learned the correct time by looking at this clock through the window. Of course, even if Stephen was telling the truth about leaving at 7:25, it still would have been possible for him to take Lynn to Lawson's Bush and kill her, though the time frame would have been much tighter, since about a dozen witnesses confirmed that he rode his bike back to the schoolyard at around 8 p.m. One of these witnesses was Stephen's older brother, Ken, who confirmed that they switched bicycles before Stephen rode back home to babysit his younger siblings. I'm sure you all know that eyewitness testimony in criminal cases can be unreliable, and there are certainly going to be examples of that in this case. But one detail which has always remained consistent is that all of the witnesses who saw Stephen arrive at the schoolyard at 8 o'clock said he looked completely normal and did not notice anything out of the ordinary. They did not recall seeing any blood or scratches on him, and even though it was a hot June evening, he did not appear to be sweating profusely or out of breath, even though he had supposedly raped and murdered Lynn only minutes earlier, something which would have required a lot of physical exertion since she was strangled to death with her own blouse. You also have to remember that Lynn's clothing was found neatly folded at the murder scene, and three branches had been taken off some trees and placed on her body. This had initially given investigators the impression that the crime was committed by an offender who took their time, but the narrow time frame indicates that Stephen would have had to do this rather quickly. So I think it's safe to say that if Stephen actually was the killer, he had to be one of the most calm, stone-cold psychopaths of all time. The most important witnesses for the Crown were Jocelyn Gaudette and Arnold Butch George, while the most important witnesses for the defense were Dougie Oates and Gord Logan. But while the two Crown witnesses told very inconsistent and constantly changing stories, and also had a known history of lying, the two defense witnesses always kept their stories simple and never wavered from them. I've already gone through the issues with Jocelyn Gaudette earlier in the episode, but as a refresher on Butch George, he captured the police's attention after word spread that he had been telling some of his schoolmates that he saw Stephen and Lynn going into Lawson's Bush together on the night of the murder. Stephen claimed that he saw Butch in the Bayfield River when he crossed the bridge on his bicycle with Lynn, but Butch would later say that Stephen had asked him to lie to the police by telling them he was there and that he saw Stephen on the bridge. Of course, the biggest issue with Butch is that even though he supposedly witnessed Stephen and Lynn entering Lawson's Bush, at no point did he ever pinpoint a specific time and place when he saw this happen, even when he was testifying under oath at trial. And in some of his statements, Butch had implied that he heard Stephen and Lynn went into the bush and did not personally witness it. Butch told so many different versions of this story that if I attempted to share each and every one of them with you on this episode, you would become so confused that your head would explode. It's so frustrating how the Crown's two key eyewitnesses seem to contradict each other's stories. Butch and Jocelyn both claimed that they bumped into each other on the tractor trail next to Lawson's Bush sometime after 7 o'clock, where Butch said that he was searching for Stephen, and Jocelyn said that she was searching for Lynn. Like I mentioned earlier, Jocelyn had originally claimed that she was at Lawson's farm between 6:30 and 8 p.m., which is obviously contradicted by Butch's account, and if Butch was asking Jocelyn if she had seen Stephen, then he obviously had not witnessed him entering the bush by this point. And yet he never provided any real confirmation if he saw Stephen and Lynn go into the bush at a later time. I mentioned in our last episode that Butch had a reputation for being a pathological liar who would make up stories for attention, and one of his schoolmates said that he was the type of person who would feed you a lie and then completely forgot what he told you 20 minutes later. Since Stephen and Butch were friends, I wouldn't say that Butch intentionally made up a story with the express purpose of falsely accusing Stephen of murder. I think it's possible he was just making up stories for the hell of it, which was something he apparently liked to do, but once this garnered the attention of the police, things got a lot more serious than he ever could have anticipated. Interestingly enough, the first known instance of Butch sharing this story occurred at around 8:20 p.m. on the evening of June the 9th, when another kid named Richard Galatly mentioned that he had recently passed by Stephen and Lynn riding a bicycle together on County Road, and Butch just casually remarked that they were in the bush together, but he didn't know what they were doing. And he then apparently kept repeating this to other kids later that night and over the course of the next few days. It's very unusual that Butch would have said this during the early evening hours of June the 9th, as Lynn had not been reported missing yet, and no one had any idea that something was wrong. But I just mentioned that Butch and Jocelyn both claimed that they had bumped into each other outside Lawson's Bush sometime after 7 p.m., and they asked each other if they had seen Stephen and Lynn. So given Butch's reputation for making up stories, perhaps this encounter later evolved into Stephen and Lynn were in the bush together, even though he never actually saw them there. If Butch was not known for being a pathological liar and was able to maintain a consistent story, I might take his statement on the evening of June the 9th as a sign he was telling the truth. But Butch probably never envisioned that he'd become the center of a murder investigation and that his little white lie would spin out of control. It's also been reported that Stephen, Butch, and three other boys went to the bridge on the evening of June the 10th, the day before Lynn's body was found, and Stephen supposedly confronted Butch over spreading the story about him and Lynn going into Lawson's bush. The Crown tried to spin it as if Stephen was angry about Butch potentially implicating him in the murder and threatening him into keeping his mouth shut, but when these three other boys testified at trial, they didn't really provide very consistent stories about what happened. In fact, only one of them made it sound like Stephen was speaking to Butch in a threatening manner, and the two others just seemed to think they were joking about the whole thing. On the morning of June the 11th, which was still a few hours before the discovery of Lynn's body, there was an incident in the school washroom between Stephen and a boy named Alan Dernan. Like he did with many others, Butch had also shared a story with Alan about having seen Stephen and Lynn go into the bush together, but while they were in the washroom, Alan made a remark that he couldn't believe Stephen gave Lynn a ride to the highway because he felt that a popular boy like Stephen would have been out of Lynn's league. Stephen responded by pushing Alan up against the wall, but a teacher walked in and separated them before things could escalate any further. Of course, at trial, the Crown painted this incident as a sign of guilt on Stephen's part, but when you consider the fact that he had been interviewed by police multiple times at this point, and his schoolmates were teasing him over an apparent lie that Butch had been sharing, you can understand why Stephen might have gotten a bit frustrated in the heat of the moment, even if he never did anything. Now, Butch also claimed that on the evening of the 10th, Stephen asked him to lie to the police and tell them he saw Stephen and Lynn riding over the bridge on their bicycle together the previous night. It is true that Butch shared a story like this with police on the morning of June the 11th, but here's the main issue with the theory that he was intentionally providing Stephen with a false alibi. According to Butch, Steve was panicky because he had originally told police that he saw Butch in the Bayfield River, but now realized that he mistook him for Gord Logan, so he wanted Butch to tell the police he had been at the river so Stephen wouldn't look suspicious. However, a search of the original police reports revealed that during his initial interviews prior to the evening of June the 10th, Stephen never mentioned anything about seeing Butch or Gord or any other boys at the river when he crossed the bridge. It wasn't until Steve was interviewed by police on the morning of June the 11th that he finally told them he remembered seeing them there. On the evening of June 10th, Lynn's body had yet to be found, and Stephen was not a suspect, and he had never told police about seeing Butch at the river, so it would be completely pointless to ask Butch to lie for him and provide him with a fake alibi, which he didn't even need at that point. At trial, Butch testified that he finally changed his story on June the 12th and denied having seen Stephen and Lynn on the bridge after he learned that Lynn's body had been found. This painted the picture that Butch had only wanted to do the right thing when he realized his friend had killed someone. But while police records showed that Butch was re-interviewed on the morning of the 12th, he actually continued to stick to his original story about seeing Stephen and Lynn. His story did not change until the next time he was re-interviewed on June the 15th, and even more curious, Butch did not formally sign any statements until June the 25th, which gives off the impression that investigators had spent some time attempting to help him craft a consistent story. This same allegation about Stephen trying to fabricate an alibi would be directed at Gord Logan, who claimed he saw Stephen and Lynn riding across the bridge together before Stephen crossed the bridge again in the opposite direction a few minutes later while he was alone. Since Stephen and Gord were friends, investigators did not put much stock into his account and figured that Gord was simply lying to help him. Well, once again, the timing doesn't really seem to support this idea, as Gord first shared his story about seeing Stephen and Lynn during an interview with police on the morning of June the 11th. At that point, no one knew that Lynn had been murdered, and Stephen was not a suspect, so Gord would have been providing Stephen with a false alibi he didn't really need. The other issue is that while Gord was friends with Stephen, the other key alibi witness, Dougie Oates, was not. Since Dougie was 3 years younger than Stephen and not a member of his social group, what motive would he have had to lie and protect an accused murderer? Since Gord was in the river about 600 feet away, investigators tried to discredit his story by saying that he couldn't have seen Stephen and Lynn from that distance. But this logic doesn't apply to Dougie, who was right next to the bridge catching turtles, and said that he waved at Lynn while she was passing by, and she smiled back at him. When this case was featured on the Fifth Estate, Dougie was interviewed, and even though 4 decades had passed, he still maintained that he saw Stephen and Lynn on the bridge that night. I'm not even sure you could say that Dougie might have been confused about the date he saw them, because I don't think there were any other previous occasions where Lynn hitched a ride on the crossbar of Stephen's bicycle. Dougie and Gord were both grilled pretty hard by the police and faced considerable pressure from them, but in spite of their young ages, they never changed their stories. I mean, I know you should never let your opinion about a case hinge on eyewitnesses because they could be mistaken or unreliable. But if Dougie and Gord's accounts are accurate, then Stephen cannot be guilty of this crime. The Crown's case had some pretty ass-backwards logic because they had one very unreliable witness who supposedly saw Stephen and Lynn go into Lawson's Bush, but no other witnesses who could corroborate this. So instead of trying to prove that they were in the bush, their primary focus was on attempting to prove that they were not on County Road, and that's where 10-year-old Philip Burns came in. As you might recall from our last episode, Philip claimed that he walked from the bridge to his home on County Road that night, but even though he supposedly did this during the time period when Stephen took Lynn to Highway 8, Philip did not recall seeing them. So by process of elimination, that must mean they went into Lawson's Bush. It's been speculated that Philip could have passed by Stephen and Lynn and simply did not notice or forgot about them, as unlike some of the other eyewitnesses in this case, I do not believe Philip was particularly close friends with them, so passing by these people on a bicycle on a seemingly uneventful night may not have been that memorable for him. The Crown also put a lot of stock into the testimony of Donna Duncan, who claimed that she drove her kids to the bridge to go swimming and arrived at around 7 p.m., where she saw another kid named Richard Galatly leaving on his bicycle right before Philip walked home. Richard claimed that he rode past Stephen and Lynn shortly before they would have reached Lawson's Bush, but since Philip was walking a few minutes behind Richard and did not see Stephen or Lynn, that would seem to lend credence to the idea that they left County Road. But here's where we get into even more issues with the fallibility of eyewitness testimony. I don't have any doubts that Donna Duncan saw Philip because he flat out walked up to her car and briefly chatted with her and her kids before he left. But was she accurate about having seen Richard Galatly leave beforehand? Could she have mistaken Richard for another kid, or just misremembered some details? Philip's brother believed that he arrived home at around 7:30, which does line up with Duncan's timeline. But if Stephen is telling the truth about having left the school at 7:25, then Philip likely would have already been off County Road by that point, which would explain why he never saw Stephen and Lynn. Richard also felt that he did not actually leave the bridge and start heading home until around 7:20, and this would fit Stephen's timeline, since Richard recalled passing by Stephen and Lynn only about 5 to 10 minutes later. Like I mentioned earlier, if this crime happened today, we now have the technology to provide a more accurate assessment of where all these people were at which times, but back in 1959, everyone had to rely on memories and guesswork. If the only evidence the Crown had against Stephen was these inconsistent eyewitness statements, it would have been much more difficult to secure a conviction, which is why they had to rely heavily on the testimony from Dr. John Peniston about Lynn's stomach contents, as well as the implication that the lesions found on Stephen's penis were the result of sexual assault. Stephen has always maintained that the two doctors who testified at the trial greatly exaggerated the size of the lesions and said they had been there for weeks prior to the murder. The Crown tried to debunk this idea by asking why Stephen never told anyone about the lesions, but he claimed he was too embarrassed, and really, how often is a 14-year-old going to openly speak to his parents about issues with his penis? While it's possible these lesions were the result of a skin condition, They also could have been caused by masturbation, and, well, that was a much more taboo subject for a teenage boy to talk about back in 1959. Another issue with putting any stock into these lesions is that we really don't know the real nature of Lynn's sexual assault. It's easy to believe that Lynn was raped since she was found partially nude, but due to the level of decomposition on her vagina, it was impossible to conclusively determine if there was any penetration, and no semen was ever found. While Lynn did appear to have injuries to her vaginal area, Dr. Peniston would acknowledge years after the trial that they could have been caused by a blunt instrument. So if Lynn's killer did not actually penetrate her on their own, then you can completely debunk the idea that this caused the lesions on Stephen's penis. On a lighter note, given the subject matter, I do find it amusing that John Peniston's surname was spelled Peniston. If I'm able to make it through this series of episodes without mispronouncing it Peniston, then I consider it a job well done. So while we're on the subject of Peniston, I'm sure you're well aware that many older wrongful convictions, which took place in the pre-DNA era, were sometimes the result of what is now considered to be junk science. If someone was charged with murder today, and the biggest piece of evidence against them was supposedly a precise assessment of when the victim digested their stomach contents, I'm not even sure the case would make it to trial, let alone result in a conviction. But I already mentioned that back in 1959, the public just had more trust in authority figures, and I think this logic would apply to doctors as well, as the jury may have automatically assumed that Dr. Peniston knew what he was talking about, and that his conclusions about Lynn's time of death must be accurate. If someone got on the witness stand today and claimed they reached their conclusions by holding up a victim's stomach contents in a jar to a light in front of a window, they would probably be laughed out of the courtroom. Now, obviously, since determining how long it takes someone's stomach to digest food is not an exact science, you can't say with 100% certainty that Peniston's original conclusions were wrong. At the Court of Appeal hearings, Stephen's defense team utilized expert testimony about entomology to push forward the idea that Lynn's death took place at a later time than Peniston suggested, but you also can't take their conclusions as absolute gospel either. The issue is that methods like this are far more useful for excluding suspects rather than directly incriminating them, but since the police absolutely needed to establish that Stephen killed Lynn during a specific window of time, it sounds like Peniston may have been encouraged to adjust his conclusions accordingly. It is troubling how none of the documentation dated prior to Stephen's arrest lists the specific 7:15 to 7:45 p.m. time of death for Lynn, and even though this time frame is listed on Peniston's official autopsy report, the report is not dated, so for all we know, he could have typed it up after Stephen was already in custody. It really seems like Peniston was doubting himself when Stephen's case was heard in front of the Supreme Court in 1966, and while Peniston never publicly recanted his original conclusions, Julian Cher was able to track down and speak to Peniston's daughter when he published Until You Are Dead. Peniston was already deceased by this point, but his daughter expressed her belief that he had been pressured by the police to reach his conclusions and was always haunted by the whole situation. Indeed, when you look at the timeline for how these series of events unfolded, this case pretty much seems to redefine the term tunnel vision. To recap, Lynn went missing on the evening of June the 9th, her body was found on the afternoon of June the 11th, and later that night, Inspector Harold Graham arrived from Toronto to head up the investigation. Since Stephen was charged with the murder during the early morning hours of June the 13th, it essentially took Graham less than 36 hours to solve the case, even though the evidence against Stephen was not particularly strong. While it came as a great shock to the community that a 14-year-old boy turned out to be the killer, it appears that the RCAAF was relieved about this because there was an initial fear that the perpetrator might turn out to be an airman, which likely would have caused a major scandal. But as we're going to talk about later, the most prominent alternate suspect in this case was an airman, and he was also a sex offender. Inspector Graham was already deceased by the time the Court of Appeal for Ontario hearings took place in 2006, but one of his former investigators, OPP Corporal Hank Sayo, was called upon to testify, and he was asked this question about Lynn's murder. Quote, Did the thought ever cross your mind that for someone to strangle her than sexually assault her, you might want to be looking for someone who is more of a pervert, more of a sexual psychopath? End quote. And Sayo's reply to this was, quote, I don't recall that. Don't get me wrong, I can totally understand why the OPP would put so much focus on Steven, as he was the last known person to see the victim alive, but it seems so irresponsible that they would not at least spend some time exploring other angles and seeing if there were any known sex offenders in the area. It would be one thing if the evidence against Steven had been overwhelming, but it most certainly was not, and it seems like Graham got tunnel vision about the boy and tried to make the evidence fit his conclusion rather than the other way around. Solving this murder seemed to provide a boost to Graham's career and paved the way to him becoming commissioner of the OPP, but in spite of all the controversy surrounding this case, he never stopped maintaining that he got the right suspect all along. However, the evidence seems to indicate that Graham did a lot of fudging of the facts in order to help secure this conviction, and I just cannot imagine how he was able to live with the possibility that he may have condemned an innocent 14-year-old kid to be hanged. So yeah, even though I've tried to remain objective and unbiased, I feel that there's pretty much no way that Stephen Truscott could have committed this crime, and I want to spend the rest of this episode looking at alternate suspects. Obviously, the most prominent one is Alexander Kalachuk, and I'll get to him soon, but there were some other interesting leads which got shoved to the side during the original investigation. This situation doesn't involve a specific suspect per se, but at around 7 p.m. on the evening of Lynn's murder, Corporal Arlene Straumann, a flight control operator from RCAF Station Clinton, went to the Custard Cup ice cream stand with one of her girlfriends. She said that three young men in a 1959 Chevrolet pulled up alongside both of them and offered them a ride, but since the women did not show any interest, the vehicle quickly drove away. I do not believe these men in the Chevy were ever identified, and for all we know, this interaction was completely harmless, but they were driving a vehicle which matched the description of the car which supposedly picked up Lynn, and Straumann's encounter took place only about a half hour earlier. After learning about what happened to Lynn, Straumann did report this incident to the military police, but it does not look like the lead was ever investigated, because the police were so focused on Steven by this point. Another potential alternate suspect was 37-year-old Clayton Dennis, who lived in the nearby town of Seaforth, and while I'm not sure if this was widespread knowledge at the time, he had previously served 3 years in prison for a rape conviction from 1948. Dennis sometimes worked as an electrician at RCF Station Clinton, and apparently did know Lynn's father, Leslie Harper, and he also moved to the United States during the fall of 1959, only months after Lynn's murder. Julie and Cher managed to track down Dennis and interview him for Until You Are Dead, and Dennis denied any involvement in the crime, claiming that he only moved away because the available work in the area had depleted. However, a family friend of Dennis would claim that after the murder took place, he made some weird remarks about Lynn in which he said, quote, she had it coming to her, or, quote, she was asking for it. But of course, since Stephen was arrested very quickly, Dennis was never investigated by law enforcement. Another potential suspect was a 19-year-old airman named Matthew Moran, who was stationed at RCAF Station Clinton in 1959. He also worked as a lifeguard at the community pool where Lynn often liked to go swimming, and transferred out of the area a short time after the murder took place. I do not believe Moran had a criminal record at that time, but he eventually got married and had two daughters, though he developed a serious alcohol problem, which led to him being dishonorably discharged from the RCAF. Moran would later be accused of beating his wife and sexually abusing his daughters, and one of them even claimed there was an incident where he brought her into the woods to rape her, but when she resisted, he attempted to strangle her before some hunters came to her rescue. When Moran's wife confronted him about attempting to rape their daughter, he allegedly replied, quote, hey, rape is better than murder. Of course, Moran was never investigated, and he died in 1985. But interestingly enough, when he was stationed in Clinton, Moran was reportedly driving his mother's late model Chevrolet. As you might recall, Stephen claimed that the car Lynn climbed into had something orange or yellow on the rear fender, which may have been a bumper sticker or license plate. Well, the Chevy belonging to Marin's mother was originally purchased in Montreal, and in 1959, Quebec had yellow license plates. There are a couple of other potential suspects who have never been named publicly. One of them was another airman who had been stationed at RCF Station Clinton in 1959, but would later go to prison for various sexual offenses during the 1980s. When police searched this man's house following his arrest, they discovered that he had a copy of the 8-volume transcript of Stephen Truscott's hearing before the Ontario Supreme Court in 1966. This doesn't prove anything, of course, but it does show that he seemed to have a major interest in this case. Another interesting unnamed individual was a minister who had been living with his family in Dungannon, a village located about 30 kilometers north of Clinton. While I don't believe this man was ever arrested or charged with any crime, his adult daughters would eventually accuse him of sexually assaulting them during their childhood. One of these daughters claimed that in 1959, when she was only 6 years old, there was an incident where she was hiding in her father's car, and he drove it out into a remote gravel road without realizing she was in the vehicle. After they stopped, she says he opened the trunk, and she then saw him carrying what appeared to be a girl's limp body towards a grassy wooded area, and he was gone for about half an hour before he returned to the car alone. Unfortunately, due to this girl's age, I'm not sure if she was able to recall any specific details about the date or locations. And since we don't know this man's identity and have no further details about his background, I can't provide much assessment about the validity of his daughter's story or if he seems to be a likely suspect in Lynn's murder. In October of 2014, a retired OPP sergeant named Barry Rule published another book about this case titled A Viable Suspect, in which he pushed forward another potential candidate to be the killer. By the time this book was published, the suspect had passed away, so in order to protect the privacy of this man's family, Rule only referred to him by pseudonym Larry Talbot, which, incidentally, also happens to be the name of the lead character that Lon Chaney Jr. played in the film The Wolfman. During the summer of 1971, Rule and his fiancée/future wife were staying at her cottage in Sauble Beach, Ontario, when a masked man broke in during the middle of the night. This man turned out to be the notorious Larry Talbot, and he seemed intent on sexually assaulting Rule's fiancée, but Rule noticed that the man was carrying a pellet gun rather than a real gun, and decided to call his bluff. When Talbot attempted to flee the scene, Rule chased after him and managed to tackle him down before he was arrested. Talbot only wound up getting a 2-year suspended sentence for this incident, and while he was never charged with any murders throughout his life, he did have an extensive criminal record for such offenses as burglary and sexual assault. Rule ultimately came to believe that Talbot may have been a serial killer who was responsible for the unsolved murders of at least 7 young women or girls, which occurred in southern Ontario from the late 1950s until the early 1990s, and one of these murders was Lynn Harper. Talbot worked as a traveling salesman and was known to have frequented the Clinton area during the 1950s, and at the time, he also apparently drove a car which would have looked similar to the vehicle that Stephen claimed to have seen. The saga of Larry Talbot is a pretty interesting rabbit hole on its own, and I don't have time to get into the whole thing here, but I would not be surprised if he was responsible for some murders during his lifetime. But much like all the other suspects in this case, there's nothing to conclusively link him to the death of Lynn Harper or place him in the area on the night of the crime. It must be clarified that there is also no direct evidence against the next individual we're going to discuss, Sergeant Alexander Kalichuk, but he is still considered to be the most compelling candidate to be Lynn's killer. We talked about Kalichuk in our last episode, but as a recap, Stephen and his supporters were completely unaware of him for decades until an old psychiatric file was unearthed during the late 1990s, so the Fifth Estate episode about this case marked the first time that Kalichuk was ever publicly named. Kalichuk had once been stationed at RCF Station Clinton, and even though he was stationed elsewhere in 1959, he often drove back to the Clinton area in order to visit his family. Since Kalichuk was never investigated, we have no idea if he was in Clinton on the night of Lynn's murder, but we do know that he was arrested for attempting to lure another young girl into his car only 3 weeks earlier. Now, this particular incident took place near the town of St. Thomas, which is less than 20 kilometers away from RCF Station Aylmer, where Kalichuk was stationed at that time. When the charges against Kalichuk for this incident were dismissed, the judge gave him a stern lecture and warned that the authorities would be watching over him. So, theoretically, if Kalachek wanted to try something like that again with another girl, it's reasonable to assume that he wouldn't do so in the same area. And if he just happened to be over 100 kilometers away in Clinton on the evening of June the 9th, and saw Lynn attempting to hitchhike, she might have seemed like a tempting target. I find it to be very interesting timing that Kalachek checked into a psychiatric clinic for depression and anxiety only about a month after Lynn's murder, and that his life just seemed to go on a complete downward spiral until his death in 1975. Even though it seems like Kalachek was definitely a sexual predator, he's never been suspected of any other murders, so if he was the man who picked up Lynn on Highway 8, it's possible that he wasn't originally planning to kill her. He may have only planned to sexually assault Lynn, but if she attempted to fight him off, things could have escalated into violence. Strangling someone to death with her own blouse appears to be an act of pure rage, but since Lynn's killer apparently took the time to neatly fold the rest of her clothing and place branches over her body, that could be an indication of guilt or remorse over what they did. And if Kalachek was the killer and became plagued with guilt, this could explain why he checked himself into a psychiatric clinic a short time later. Now, by the time Kalachek checked himself in, Stephen was already in custody for Lynn's murder, so it's not like he should have been feeling overwhelming paranoia that the authorities were going to come after him. But if Kalachek found out that an innocent kid was taking the fall for his crime, he may have felt guilty about it, but not so guilty that he was willing to turn himself in and make a confession. Theoretically, this could provide an explanation for the appearance of Lynn's locket on the barbed wire fence near Lawson's Bush. We still can't be 100% certain that the locket was not there all along and the police simply missed it, but if the real killer placed it on the fence on June the 18th or the 19th, it doesn't make much sense for them to do so since Stephen was already in jail. I'm not sure if the perpetrator intentionally held onto it, but if Lynn was murdered inside a car, it's possible the locket could have come off during a struggle, and the killer did not even realize it was in their vehicle until days after the fact. Planting the locket near the murder scene could have been their way of letting the authorities know they had gotten the wrong guy without actually revealing their own identity. But of course, by this point, the authorities were so locked in on pinning the crime on Stephen that the sudden appearance of the locket didn't make any difference. Now, the one thing which might go against Kalachek being the perpetrator is that he was driving a light yellow Pontiac Stratochief at the time, rather than a gray-colored Chevrolet, but the vehicles looked similar enough that when viewed from a distance during the early evening hours, it's possible that Stephen could have mixed them up. After all, Kalachek sold his Stratochief a short time later, which struck everyone as odd since he had only purchased it recently. And remember, we can't even be 100% certain that the driver who picked up Lynn on Highway 8 was the person who murdered her, as it's possible that they could have driven her elsewhere and dropped her off, and she crossed paths with her killer at a later time. We still don't know the significance of the yellow or orange object that Stephen said he saw on the car's rear fender. It may have been a license plate from a province which had colorful plates at that time, such as Quebec, or it could have simply been a reflection of the sun on the fender, and it has no significance. The biggest issue that Stephen's detractors have always had with this story is that if Lynn climbed into a car which was heading east, why would her killer circle back and head south down County Road to place her body in Lawson's Bush? Well, since we have a window of over 40 hours between when Lynn went missing and her body was found, we really can't be sure when and where she was killed. While there was blood on Lynn's clothing, there was virtually no blood anywhere in the woods or near the crime scene, so this has led to speculation that she was murdered at another location before the killer placed her in Lawson's Bush. I mentioned earlier that an intriguing eyewitness sighting, which was withheld from Stephen's defense team at his trial, was provided by Bob Lawson, who claimed that around 10 p.m., he saw a red convertible parked next to the tractor trail into the bush, and as the owner of this property, Lawson said it was very unusual for people to park there. He also thought he saw a male in the driver's seat and a shorter female in the passenger seat, which possibly could have been Lynn. Lawson decided to shine his lights on the vehicle, and a few minutes later, it sped past him while he was swimming in the Bayfield River, and someone apparently shouted obscenities in his direction. Now, it's easy to assume that this might have been Lynn's killer, but the big issue is that this red convertible does not match the description of the vehicle that Steven saw. And if Lawson did see Lynn in the front seat, then I'm not sure there would have been enough time for the driver to kill her, drag her body into the bush, and then speed away past the river a few minutes later. So it's possible that this was nothing more than a couple who had stopped there in order to make out, and got pissed when Lawson shone his lights on them. But even so, the Crown's calculated decision to withhold this piece of evidence from the defense lessened their chances to create reasonable doubt and secure an acquittal for their client. Once again, the big issue is that it sounds like Inspector Graham and the rest of the OPP never bothered to investigate any leads which did not involve Stephen Truscott, even though there were other people in the area at that time who seemed a lot more capable of a crime like this than a 14-year-old with no known history of violence. In many wrongful conviction cases, the investigators were facing immense pressure to solve the crime and reached the point where they had no solid leads and it hit a brick wall. You got the sense that they were desperate enough to pin the crime on anyone, regardless of whether or not they were the right person. But we didn't even reach that point in this case, as Stephen Truscott was charged with murder only about 36 hours after the discovery of the victim's body, without any other potential leads being explored. So yeah, even though Stephen was not declared factually innocent per se, I'm 100% comfortable saying he did not commit this crime, and that a serious miscarriage of justice took place. But at least unlike many other wrongfully convicted individuals, Stephen did manage to get out of prison without even being exonerated, and managed to build up a good life for himself and his family. And everyone who's met Stephen has said that for someone who has experienced such a terrible injustice, he is remarkably not bitter and seems grateful for everything he does have. But sadly, in many wrongful conviction cases, the actual victim of the crime is often lost in the shuffle, and that's certainly the case with Lynn Harper. Since she was murdered at such a young age, Lynn was deprived of the opportunity to start a family and lead a good life like Stephen did. And I can understand why this would be particularly heartbreaking for the Harper family, who continue to believe that Stephen killed her, but barring the uncovering of conclusive evidence which points to another suspect, I'm not sure that anything will ever change their mind. In recent years, genetic genealogy has helped lead to the resolution of cold cases which are years, if not decades old, as it can link DNA evidence to a suspect who is already deceased, and posthumously prove that they committed the crime. Lest the perpetrator happened to be around Stephen Truscott's age back in 1959, I think it's safe to say that Lynn's real killer is probably no longer with us, but without DNA evidence, it will be difficult, if not outright impossible, to prove who did it. I do personally believe that of all the suspects we've mentioned, Alexander Kalachuk seems like the most promising candidate, but there's no way I could be absolutely certain of his guilt, since he was never thoroughly investigated, and there was no real evidence to link him to the crime. For all we know, the real killer may be someone who has never popped up on the radar. However, even if we never know the full truth about what happened, it's important for Lynn Harper's memory to be kept alive and for Stephen Truscott's story to be told and cited as an example of what happens when the justice system goes horribly wrong. So that brings an end to our special two-part anniversary episode. And if you happen to have any information about the murder of Lynn Harper, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. We also wanted to remind everyone that during the month of February, The Trail Went Cold has teamed with a nonprofit organization called Season of Justice, which raises money for the families of cold case victims by helping spread awareness and attempting to fund such initiatives as DNA testing. If you would like to make a donation to Season of Justice, all of the information about this is listed in our show notes and on our social media pages, but you can donate by visiting the link givebutter.com/SOJ_the trail or by clicking a special donate button for them on our website or by texting trail24 to 53555. That's givebutter.com/SOJ_the trail or you can also text trail24 to 53555 or use the donate button at our website, trailwentcold.com. We wanted to provide another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about a very memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the disappearance of wanted fugitive Randall Utterback, who has not been seen since he broke out of jail nearly 30 years ago. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1989 disappearance of Patricia Meehan. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Andrew Z, Roni C, Lizzie, and Annabelle K. Thank you all so much for your support. I also wanted to remind everyone that later this year, The Trail Went Cold has been booked to appear on Podcast Row at two separate Crime Con events. The American Crime Con, which is taking place at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May the 31st until June the 2nd, and Crime Con UK, which is taking place at 133 Houndsditch in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a specialized promo code to get a 10% discount at both events, so please visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL24. Once again, that's crimecon.com and crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets to both events. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. They've both been with me on this podcast these entire 8 years and provided tremendous support, and I never would have gotten The Trail Went Cold off the ground without them. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Anyway, it's surreal to think that The Trail Went Cold has reached its 8-year anniversary milestone, and of course, we never would have made it this far without the amazing support of you, the listeners, so thank you so much. I'm actually going to be on vacation next week, but while I'm gone, The Trail Went Cold will be dropping another special update episode. Yes, I know we just released our last update episode at the end of December, but believe it or not, there have been a lot of resolutions and developments and Trail Went Cold cases since the start of 2024, so we've got a bunch of new material to talk about. So thank you all again for your support, and have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday as we start off year 9 of our podcast with another special update episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶